Sorry.
Jihad, Jihad, Jihad. Good afternoon. I'm Ann Bancroft. I'm the minister here at the Theodore Parker Church, and I want to thank our house band for their contributions to this afternoon's amazing. I continue to be surprised and delighted. We're very pleased to welcome Rabbi Brian Walt this afternoon to be our first lecturer in the Theodore Parker Church series. His work, which you will hear about in his introduction shortly, qualifies him as someone who works to bend the moral arc toward justice for all in an environment that challenges moral choices like few we have confronted. I am grateful to members of this congregation who have worked hard to provide this forum for our collective learning. I know it will be a fruitful afternoon for all of us. So welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Julie McVeigh. I'm a member of the congregation and an amateur historian. I want to introduce Theodore Parker to you this afternoon. Theodore Parker was our minister here in West Roxbury from 1837 to 1846, and then in Boston until 1860. During the lead-up to the Civil War, his voice was very important in carrying the message of social justice widely. He spoke clearly, using language understood by common people. There is a brief biographical sketch about him in the program. Early in his ministry, Theodore experienced rejection by his ministerial colleagues for his religious view, which wounded him deeply. But he discovered that his message was welcomed by people throughout New England and as far west as Illinois and Kansas. In Boston, his congregation numbered in the thousands each Sunday, while his midweek Lyceum lectures spread theological, democratic, and social messages to thousands more beyond the Boston area. In the mid-1800s, Boston experienced great social ferment, and Parker's friends were often leading in the attempts to improve social conditions. He regularly supported them in his sermons and lectures. Theodore spoke to every man and made the most revolutionary ideas reasonable. Here are a few of his examples. I cannot help thinking that labor is often wickedly underpaid and capital sometimes grossly overfed. I shall believe that capital is at the mercy of labor when the two extremes of society change places. About women's rights, he said, not allowing women equal access to education and commerce robs the country of half the resources available to it. After the Fugitive Slave Act passed, he said, I will do all in my power to rescue any fugitive slave from the hands of any officer who attempts to return him to bondage with such strength as I can command. And later, he said, the fugitive has the same natural right to defend himself against the slave catcher, and it's the same right he has against a murderer or a wolf. Parker also said, the arc of the universe is long and it bends towards justice, a phrase Martin Luther King used often. Lincoln did not know Parker, but a mutual friend did. Likely, Lincoln read a printed sermon of Theodore's and saw the phrase, "Democracy is government of the people, by the people, and for the people." As friends and parishioners sought to support Theodore in his difficult work, he welcomed the diversions they provided. His presence in our sanctuary each week, if you'll notice, that's our Theodore, reminds us of our role in supporting the prophetic voices of our own times and the imperative to continue his legacy of activism and love. Each Sunday, this congregation repeats a poem that Parker wrote, and I would like to share it with you in closing. Be ours a religion which, like sunshine, goes everywhere. Its temple, all space. Its shrine, the good heart. Its creed, all truth. Its ritual, works of love. Its profession of faith, divine living.
Once more, good afternoon. My name is Diana Diggs, and I'm co-chair with Andrea Sherez of our church's Social Action Committee, and it is a real pleasure, a deep pleasure, to introduce Rabbi Brian Walt today to inaugurate the Theodore Parker Lecture Series on Social Justice. Of the four justice issues that we at Theodore Parker are addressing through education and campaigns, mass incarceration, economic inequality, climate change, and Israel-Palestine, this last one is surely the most complex, the most emotional, and the most challenging. Theodore Parker set a really high bar, but I can think of no better inaugural speaker to help us embrace his legacy than Rabbi Brian Walt, with his experience in South Africa, Israel-Palestine, and the United States. Rabbi Brian was born in Cape Town and grew up in a traditional Jewish family and community in South Africa. He is profoundly connected to the prophetic tradition and ethical core of Judaism. When he graduated from high school, as a progressive Zionist, he made Aliyah to Israel, where he studied at the Hebrew University for 2 years. He completed his undergraduate degree at the University of Cape Town, where he was active in the struggle against apartheid. He was the founding editor of Strike, a Jewish student newspaper on Jewish values and apartheid. Inspired by activist organizations such as Jews for Urban Justice and the Havura movement, Rabbi Brian immigrated to the United States in 1974. He completed a master's degree in education at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, and in 1984, he was ordained as a rabbi by the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. 4 years later, he founded Mishkan Shalom, an activist synagogue in Philadelphia. That synagogue has been a leader in supporting peace groups in Israel and in opening discussion in the Jewish community on the issues of justice and human rights for the Palestinian people. Rabbi Walt is the rabbi emeritus of that congregation. In 2003, he became the founding executive director of Rabbis for Human Rights in North America, after years of bearing witness with Rabbis for Human Rights in Israel and the West Bank. He is also a founding member of the Jewish Voice for Peace Rabbinical Council, described as a fast-growing network of rabbis, cantors, and rabbinical students. We are very grateful to have you with us today, Rabbi Brian. Please welcome to Theodore Parker Church, Rabbi Brian Walt.
Well, thank you so much for your warm welcome. It's really wonderful to be here in this sacred spot, the sanctuary, and it's a great honor to be invited to offer this inaugural Theodore Parker lecture. Theodore Parker stands in the line of the prophets, starting with the prophets of ancient Israel, continuing in every generation, in all religions and societies, down to our time. I'm humbled by the task of honoring such an inspiring leader and giving voice to the prophetic challenge of our own time. Rabbi Abram Joshua Heschel, who marched with Martin Luther King, which described that marching as praying with his feet, wrote his doctoral dissertation as a young man in Berlin, in Germany, prior to World War II. He wrote in this work, magnificent work on the prophets, he writes the following. To us, a single act of injustice, cheating in business, exploitation of the poor is slight. To the prophets, a disaster. To us, injustice is injurious to the welfare of the people. To the prophets, it is a death blow to existence. We think that prophetic insensitivity to injustice, such as is modeled by Theodore Parker and so many others in history and in our time, is often hysterical. But Heschel, they're extremists. We think of prophets as extremists. But says Heschel, if such deep insensitivity to evil is called hysterical, what name should be given to the abysmal indifference that the prophet bewails? For Heschel, for the prophets, the opposite of good is not evil. The opposite of the good is indifference. Prophecy is the voice, this is the words of Heschel again. Prophecy is the voice that God has lent to the silent agony, a voice to the plundered poor, to the profaned riches of the world. God is raging in the prophet's words. So Theodore Parker was such a prophet and such a person, as we heard earlier, just a few moments ago, played a major role in the abolition of the evil of slavery, in upholding rights, equal rights for women, and challenging sexism, in opposing militarism, opposing the Mexican War. And like most prophets, for Theodore Parker, there was a cost for his prophetic words. Prophecy doesn't come cheaply. There's a cost. So in honor of this man who broke the silence and spoke the truth, I've entitled my talk for today, The Prophetic Challenge, Breaking the Silence, Speaking the Truth. First, I want to briefly just describe the values of prophetic religion, and then I want to apply those values to the issue at hand, the issue of Israel and Palestine. I want to explore why many people, including many people of faith, many good people who are actively engaged in many issues of justice, are particularly silent about this issue, the issue of Palestine. As we heard earlier, that in fact, you have four issues that you've taken on as a congregation, and you acknowledge that the fourth issue is in some ways the most complicated, the most challenging. And the question is why? And what to do about that? That's what I want to address today. And I will address it from my own perspective, which is a very limited perspective. It is the perspective today of a Jew who's connected to the prophetic tradition, who's connected to Israel, and who's deeply committed to justice for Palestinians. People who raise questions about justice for the Palestinians quickly learn that this territory is dangerous territory. I have a Jewish friend who worked in the South, moved into the Deep South in the 1960s, and worked there as a racial justice worker. and has recently taken on, in recent years, the issue of solidarity with Palestinians. And she reports that working for solidarity for Palestinians is in some ways far more difficult in terms of resistance than it was for her to work as a white person in the Deep South. As a rabbi, I won't tell you these stories, but obviously as a rabbi, I'm very familiar with what the cost is. I'm deeply familiar with what the fear is, the fear that holds us back from speaking courageously about an issue, a profound and urgent issue of justice. And I'm very familiar with the way the response of Jews and often of Jewish organizations when we speak out about Palestine. I want in my talk also to address how we may better understand those people who are outraged by any criticism of the state of Israel. And how may we best respond to those who invest so much energy and so much resources in silencing, monitoring, and containing this issue? So, first a few words about prophetic religion, and then we'll jump into Israel-Palestine. I want to highlight just three principles of prophetic religion. They're probably familiar principles we all know, but it's good for us to be reminded. At the heart of prophetic religion of all kinds, and I'm saying prophetic faith in a broadest universal sense, is the idea that the pursuit of justice is at the center of the religious life. God calls us to create a just and a compassionate reality for all God's creatures. Heschel, who moved me deeply and was my teacher, although I never met him, I regard him as my teacher, I regard myself as being his student. Heschel talked about God's pathos, God's love, God's concern about human beings and wanting human beings to create compassion and justice for all people, that God, in his time, he wrote a book called God in Search of Man, God in Search of Humanity, searching for humanity to create the kind of world that God, that is in the image of God and that honors all of God's creatures. Justice, justice shall you pursue is the central command of prophetic religion. Number two, God stands with the poor, the vulnerable, and the oppressed, and asks us to do the same, right? God is not neutral. God is not even-handed on issues of justice because God believes that neutrality or even-handedness on issues of injustice is just another way to perpetuate injustice and oppression. We're called to take sides. We are called to take sides, and we are called to stand in solidarity with those who are the victims of injustice. And lastly, and the third principle is the one that's been proclaimed in America's streets these past few weeks: no justice, no peace. There is no peace without justice. A peace without justice is no peace. I learned those three teachings of prophetic Judaism, prophetic faith, as a young child growing up in one of the most brutal and oppressive societies on the face of the earth ever, the society of apartheid South Africa. And I grew up deeply, as a deeply immersed Jew, in my own tradition, in my religious tradition, and in my own study of scripture. When I was 15 years old, and I was in my Jewish school, I had the remarkable privilege and gift of studying the words of the book of Amos. Spare me. I loathe, I spurn your festivals. I'm not appeased by your solemn assemblies. Spare me the sound of your hymns and let me not hear of your lutes, but let justice well up like water and righteousness like a mighty stream. Those words literally changed my life. They in some way made me to become a rabbi. They in some way saved me as a Jew. Because in my reality, I was taught about justice, but in my reality, there was much too high a wall, Jews refer to a mechitza, a separation, between what happened in the beautiful synagogues where I went and prayed and sang and was moved by prayers and what was happening outside. As a young person, it meant for me that my tradition had spoken to my heart and my reality. Until this day, I love the fact that Judaism, on its holiest day, at the holiest moment of that day, Yom Kippur, assigns the reading of the prophetic portion from Isaiah that says, "Is this the fast that I desire? Yet fast merely to deprive your body? Is not this the fast that I desire, the unlocking of the chains of wickedness, the loosening of exploitation, the freeing of the oppressed? Share your bread with the hungry, with all who starve. Bring the wretched poor into your house and clothe the naked." For many, that is what I learnt as a child. It is the faith that sustains me till this very day. It's not an easy faith. It's often challenging. It's often profoundly challenging. But it is the deepest faith I have. For many liberal Jews, it is Abram Joshua Heschel, who is marching with Dr. King from Selma to Montgomery, that best exemplifies those core principles. And even though there are many Jews who regard that man, Abram Joshua Heschel, and that event as the core of their faith, there also for them is often a complete divide between all justice issues and the issue of Palestine. Heschel said, who joined King in encouraging King and also himself became a vocal opponent of militarism and of the war in Vietnam, said this very blunt and provocative statement, quote, "To speak of God and to be silent about Vietnam is blasphemy. To speak of God and to be silent about Vietnam is blasphemy. We just need to fill in the dotted line." And so let's make a transition to the silence about the issue of the Palestinians. How come so many people actively engaged in struggles of justice of all kinds are silent about Palestine? Why is there the phenomenon of PEP, progressive, except for Palestine? And so, as a Jew, I know that that has a lot to do with the feelings of my own community, and so I hope you will allow me to share some of what those feelings are in our community and how we can best understand them. The most important thing, I think, for people to understand who don't understand how this works in the Jewish community is to understand that for many Jews, Israel is primarily about their Jewish identity. It lies at the core of what it means to them to be Jewish. In some ways, it lies more at the core of what it means to be Jewish than do all the prayers, all the theology, all the holidays, all the sacred customs, all the history of the Jewish people doesn't measure up in any way to the importance of Israel to their Jewish identity. Particularly, this is true of Jews 50 and older, but not only. Israel represents for Jews the survival of the Jewish people, and it represents their personal survival in the face of centuries of persecution and victimization, much of it legitimated and often fomented by the Christian church. Many Jews draw a direct line between this painful history of victimization that led to the Holocaust and the creation of the State of Israel. Israel did, in fact, at a moment of Jewish history, when Jews were in one of the most dire situations of any human group in human history, Israel did, in fact, provide refuge for many Jews at a time when there were few, if any, other places that would offer such safety. For many Jews, their Jewishness has to do with this survival and the flourishing of the State of Israel rather than any religious precepts of Judaism. By the way, you know that I, as a liberal rabbi, could say almost anything about anything in my faith that is totally transgressive about the faith. I could say, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in this passage in the Torah. I could say, I don't even believe in the Torah. I could say almost anything. And barely would people even notice what I said. But if I were at any moment to criticize the state of Israel, I should better be really careful that it could literally mean the end of my pulpit, my employment as a rabbi. My wife recently brought me a full-size copy of a cartoon that appeared in the New Yorker of Moses leading the people of Israel across the Red Sea. And you see this image of Moses leading all the people across the Red Sea. And the byline, the caption at the bottom reads, two Jews talking to one another and saying to one another, I just wish he were a little more pro-Israel. I want to also say that for many Jews who are deeply connected to Jewish culture, and I'm including myself here, the revival of Hebrew and Hebrew culture in Israel is a very, very important thing to our faith and to our Jewishness. And it's a very wonderful part of what Israel has provided for Jews in our time. Lastly, I want to say, for many Jews, there is no separation whatsoever between Judaism and Zionism. Judaism is Zionism, it's a mix. It's all wrapped together in one. Everything I've said so far about the way Jews think of Israel, I know in here. It's not like I'm talking about something I read in a book. It's what I grew up with. It's what I believed for much of my life. And some of it I still believe, but it was what I believed. Much of what I just said I don't believe, but I believed it for much of my life. So when others, Jew or non-Jew, who have personally witnessed or read about an injustice to the Palestinians and raise questions about that injustice with their Jewish friends, colleagues, the Jewish colleague or friend may perceive, may not even notice the content of what the injustice is, but rather will respond, see their comments as a personal, existential attack on the survival of the Jewish people. They may not even hear the details of the injustice, but will just simply hear it as an expression of anti-Semitism of non-Jews and of Christians in particular. So that's what happens on a personal level. I imagine, I hope in the question and answer, either with me or between you, you can talk about, I know that many people have this experience with Jews where raising the question of Palestine is just very surprising in terms of the response and the intensity of the response. So that's on the personal level. But we also need to talk about on an institutional level, because it doesn't only happen on a personal level. On an institutional level, the Israeli government, AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, mainstream Jewish organizations across the board, every single one, last one, have developed a sophisticated and well-resourced series of organizations that monitor, track, intimidate, stifle, silence any attention that's placed to the injustice against the Palestinians. They monitor rabbis, they monitor academics, they monitor college students, they monitor politicians, they monitor clergy, they monitor churches, and they watch and they act as guardians of the state of Israel in monitoring that the state of Israel is not attacked. And anyone, not only people of other faiths, any Jew as well, any rabbi too, who dares to cross that line has to be ready to pay the cost. Many people pay the cost. Countless numbers of people have had to pay the cost. If you think of the most devastating events, just even think about Gaza this past summer. And if you think about Professor Salata, who was denied a position at the University of Illinois because he tweeted a position, an academic position, that he had been granted and that his family was moving to Illinois for. And he's a celebrated professor. There's not a question about his credential. The opposite. He was recruited by University of Illinois, and because he tweeted comments critical of Israel during the Gaza War, he lost that position. Or Bruce Shipman, the Episcopal chaplain at Yale, who lost his position because he wrote a 3-sentence-long letter to the New York Times that linked the rise in anti-Semitism across the world to Israel's actions in the West Bank and Gaza. If you want to know all the gory details of this monitoring, intimidation, stifling, silencing that goes on, you can go to the Jewish Voice for Peace website and go to a wonderful project called Muzzle Watch, and Muzzle Watch watches and documents all the muzzling that goes on in various contexts around this issue. This summer, after those devastating events in Gaza, the killing of over 2,000 people, including over 500 children, right? The question was that the high holidays were coming. And suddenly people awoke, and even the New York Times awoke to the idea that rabbis are silent about this question. And it became a national issue about, well, what are rabbis going to say, if anything, about Gaza? I encountered that often in terms of Rabbis for Human Rights, where I would work with rabbis who would venture to say anything about Palestine, or even. One of my jobs in Rabbis for Human Rights was to bring a Zionist, committed Zionist rabbi from Israel to come and speak in synagogues in the United States, and mostly we couldn't get an audience for him to speak in a synagogue. He most often spoke in churches, and to tell you the truth, I don't remember this is just a sidebar about myself. In the past 4 years, I don't think I've been invited to speak once in a synagogue, right? Other than my own. They suffer me there. They suffer me there. So I don't do this to scare you. I mean, I don't want to scare you. I don't want to add to the fear. But I do want you to understand what the field is in which we're operating, both personally and institutionally. And also to understand why it is that so many people are silent, and why it is, I guess, in the Unitarian denomination too, that it will be a difficult conversation that you're going to have and are having about this question, for which I admire you greatly, for the conversation at least. And yet, then the question is, well, why take on this issue? Climate change will be much better. Everyone agrees that climate change is not good, right? Would be. Even economic inequality would be much easier. No one's really here. I doubt there are many people here this afternoon who think economic inequality is not a good issue for us to be engaged with. And I forgot the third one. Climate change? Mass incarceration. So racism. Yeah. That also would not be that's an important movement that's happening, but it wouldn't have the same charge as here. So the question is, why not leave it aside? And the answer is very simple. Our government, your government and my government, is the primary enabler, supporter that enables the injustice to the Palestinians. It starts here, starts right here. We give massive aid to Israel. We protect Israel in all major fora. We act against Palestinians again and again and again. We bear direct responsibility, you and I. We bear direct responsibility. A few months ago, in June, I had the privilege of giving a talk at the UU Convention with Saeed Ashtan, a wonderful Palestinian activist. And one thing that he said always struck me and has stayed with me since that night that we spoke together. He turned to the audience that night and he said, you know, I just have one basic thing that I request of you. Please remove your complicity in the oppression of my people. All I want from you, just remove it. You don't even just stop the complicity of your complicity, our complicity, in the oppression of my people. Our government is directly responsible for the oppression of the Palestinian. For all of us, it is something we're involved with and that we need to respond to. For those of us who are Jewish, for me, who is Jewish, I believe I have an added responsibility, because I'm not just American, I'm American and I'm Jewish. My community is, as you heard, very involved in enabling the injustice to the Palestinians by silencing the issue and by acting against, to stifle any movement towards Palestinian solidarity in the United States. The oppression of the Palestinian people is done in my name, in the name of my faith, Judaism, and in the name of my people, the Jewish people. I don't have any other issue, in my humble opinion, that's as important. I also don't have any issue that's less difficult, right? It's the most difficult, and it's the most important. And so I have to respond. So how do we respond? So one is, as I was writing this talk, I did a writing class, and they suggested try come up with threes. So I came up with threes, which is compassion, clarity, and courage. So I'm going to put it in those categories: compassion, clarity, and courage. Compassion. I want to urge us to be very compassionate to Jews who criticize and who go get very exercised when they hear any criticism of the state of Israel. We need to be compassionate that they are responding out of fear to changes in our community and to an important potential loss of an important part of their own Jewish identity. That's what they're responding to. And that deserves compassion, because they are called to lose something important that is important to them, that has to be lost, it has to be changed, they need to move forward. The work is an important part of their Jewish identity. I believe we need to be compassionate, but the work is their work. It's not your work. It's not my work. It's their work. And we need your compassion, and I'm now speaking as a Jew, to, as it were, I mean, these lines between Jews and people of faith are so weird. I mean, here we are, a congregation. I'm pretty much would define myself as a universal Jew. I'm more of a Unitarian in regard to Judaism than anything else, and more of a Unitarian in regard to all religions than anything else. So, but I do want to say that non-Jews need to have compassion for Jews, but need to also respect that it's Jews who need to sort this out, not them. And that non-Jews, people of other faiths, should not in any way mute or stifle their acts of conscience based on the fact that it's difficult for Jews. It's unconscionable that at college campuses, the argument that's made against supporting justice for the Palestinians is that it will make Jewish students uncomfortable. Since when is the discomfort of a particular group of students an issue to shut down activism for justice for a people that's oppressed? It just doesn't make any sense. And we don't need you to do that, and we don't need that to happen there. They need to do it, and they need compassion for doing it. And if the Jewish community was smart, it would hire rabbis and other people to work with Jews as they think through these issues. As it is, we have Jewish Voice for Peace and other organizations that do help people, Jews, as we go through this. But it's not your job to do so. Nor do you, if you are not Jewish here, do you need my permission or the permission of Jews in order to be a person who supports justice for the Palestinians. It's nice that you've invited me here today, and I'm delighted to be here, but you don't need what I say here today, nor do you need my kosher certificate for you to go on and do justice work. You need to follow your faith. You need to live by your faith just as I do, and I'd be delighted to see, to do that together with you. So that's compassion. Second, clarity. Historically, Jews have suffered terribly as victims. That we need to be clear about that. Historically, Jews have suffered terribly as victims. We need to be clear about that. And we need to be clear, in our time, in this situation in Israel-Palestine, Jews are not the victims. They are the victimizers, and the Palestinians are the victims. So we need to be equally clear about that. Both of those are true. Jews historically have been victims, but in the present situation, Jews hold power over the Palestinians and are the victimizers and oppressors of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians are subject to a systemic oppression at the hands of the state of Israel. Another point of clarity that I want to suggest is that criticizing Israeli policy is not anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is hatred for Jews. Criticizing Israeli policy is criticizing a nation state that is acting unjustly, just as most nation states do in the world. I don't know of many that don't act unjustly, but criticizing the state of Israel is just criticizing a nation state for its unjust policies, the same way as we as Americans criticize our own nation state for the evil that it does. Courage. I think the most important courage we need is to stand in solidarity with Palestinians for justice. We need to join a growing movement, a worldwide movement, that is struggling for justice and ultimately for justice for all people, for Jews, for Palestinians, for all people who live in that region. There's a growing grassroots movement, as you know, in the churches. The Presbyterian Church just passed a resolution about joining the movement for BDS, for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. There's Kairos, there's a Christian call, Palestinian Christian call to Christians from a perspective of Christian liberation theology that is called a call to Christians, people who define themselves as Christians throughout the world, to join them in their struggle for justice. BDS is probably the most growing grassroots worldwide movement. It is rights-based, it is non-violent, it is not based on a particular solution, and it offers people in their communities the opportunity to act on this issue, and it's initiated by the victims. It's initiated by people who are suffering that injustice, who have called on us to help them in trying to get justice in terms of lands, in terms of their own human rights, basic human rights. And I want to say that while I described the fear that Jews have, mostly over the age of 50, the Jewish community is changing rapidly, really rapidly. First of all, most younger Jews don't have those connections to the fear and victimization of the Holocaust. And for them, they've lived in a world where Israel has been one of the most powerful nation states in the world with one of the most powerful armies. And often they don't have, unless they've been involved in congregational education and Zionist education, they don't necessarily have much connection to the state of Israel, but they do have connection to their tradition and to the tradition of the pursuit of justice. So there's great opportunity for interfaith cooperation that is happening at the Presbyterian Church. Jewish Voice for Peace and rabbis from Jewish Voice for Peace were very involved with Presbyterians who were in their own church trying to grapple with this question, as people who were standing in solidarity with the Presbyterians as they tried to figure out how to act on the basis of their faith. So there's an expanding opportunity for interfaith, a new kind of interfaith connection between Jews and other people of faith. The interfaith connection in America until now has always been Jews will be in an interfaith connection with Christians on the implicit and often explicit agreement that the Christians will not raise the question of Palestine. That doesn't have to be the way the interfaith alliance works. That isn't the way it should be. It needs to be an interfaith alliance where people can join based on our faith to act on all issues, including this issue, with the kind of compassion, clarity, and courage that I talked about earlier. So I want to end by, because I want to leave time for us to talk a little bit, is I want to say a word about Unitarian Universalists. I want to say that for me, I know some, I'm not an expert on Unitarian Universalist churches, but I've spoken in many. My very first pulpit that I served in 19, there was a four-year period in my bio that didn't, which was my first pulpit, which is the pulpit that I went into after my ordination, raised the issue of Palestine and lost the pulpit, and then created the one 4 years later. I don't know why that there was that. It's my fault, but yes. But the first person who invited me when I moved to Media was the Unitarian minister, and I went to Morris Hutchins, and I think he's still alive. I looked him up recently. Yes, and Morris Hutchins invited me to his church, and I came there, and I spoke to many, many, many more Jews than were in my services on Saturday at the synagogue. And I have great admiration for the Unitarian Universalist Church, for its principles, for its commitment to justice. For me, it's been a church that has upheld the prophetic mission, even apart from Theodore Parker, the church as itself. And indeed, it's really important that the Unitarian Universalist Church address this issue. There is no difference between the systemic oppression of the Palestinian people and the systemic oppression of people of color in this country. And if we're going to be advocates against racism, challenging racism in this country, there's no way in which you can make a separation and say racism here is okay, but racism here is not okay, but racism there will be okay. So two trips to Israel. I went to two trips to Israel, one in 2008 and one in 2012. They both changed my life. The first trip in 2008, I went as the executive director of Rabbis for Human Rights, and it was, in fact, shortly after that trip that I left that position because I could no longer, after that trip, uphold what I believed before, because I grew up believing in Zionism. I grew up believing that the very committed to a Zionism that would give equality to all people, and believing that the injustices to the Palestinian people that were happening in the state of Israel were like warts. They were warts. And we would get, you know how you deal with warts, you get rid of them. Some people struggle with them, but you do get rid of them. You treat them and you get rid of the wart, right? And I thought it was a wart on a dream. What I encountered in 2008 was I went from one, I had traveled a lot through the West Bank, I traveled a lot through Israel, and at every stage where I went, what I encountered was that the treatment of Jews was different than the treatment of non-Jews, be it Bedouin, be it Palestinians, be it Israeli Arab citizens, that somehow there was a fundamental racism that was built in here, a systemic discrimination that privileged Jews and discriminated against people of other faiths. On that trip, traveling, how many of you have traveled to Palestine? Wow, look at that. Man, that's amazing. A lot of people here. So you didn't need this talk at all. I should be listening to you. So and when you travel, you know, you see terrible things when you travel through Palestine, Israel, if you go to see them. Most people don't go to see them. So I happened to be with Rabbis for Human Rights in 2008, and Rabbis for Human Rights does really good work challenging the demolition of homes. And I was in a home that was demolished, and I was standing on the rubble of the home. I think it had been demolished 2 days earlier, and a father comes and tells the story of how when they came to demolish the home, kids started throwing stones at the bulldozers that were destroying the home. And then the Israeli authorities, security personnel, took video of the children. And then late at night, they came and arrested some of these children, 9-year-old, 10-year-old, 12-year-old children. And he had just come back from a military court where he had been with his child who had been awakened. And I think his child was not more than 12 years old. And he brought in, was clearly a traumatized parent, clearly a traumatized child. And I was a Zionist. I was someone who believed in the state of Israel and wanted to support the state of Israel. And it became a real crisis for me. And I went to one of my colleagues, a man by the name of Rabbi Yechiel Greneman, who's a rabbi who goes from one home demolition to another. So he goes to it often. And I said to him, Yechiel, I can't stand to be here. I just want to get out of here. But you go to these all the time. How do you do it? My head's exploding here. I said, how do you do it? And he turned to me, looked me straight in the eye, and said to me, Brian, what do you mean? How do I do it? How do you do it? You pay for it. You pay for it. That's what we do. I went in 2012 with a group of interfaith group, of which included some leaders of the civil rights movement from the 1960s, including Dorothy Cotton and some other folk from that time. It was basically turned out to be an interfaith delegation that had a large contingent of African Americans and a large contingent of Jews, and then some contingent of people of other faiths and activists who had been there. And I landed up in this remarkable encounter in Nabi Saleh. Nabi Saleh, many of you know, but I assume some of you may not, is a small village on the West Bank which has been in a principled, unarmed resistance to the stealing of their land for years now, for years. Every Friday they go off and protest the confiscation of their land and the confiscation of their well, their village well, which is now part of the settlement that you can see right from Nabi Saleh. I forget the name right now of the settlement. But we're there, and we're there for the Friday to march with them in their demonstration, and we're there sleeping overnight in the home of one of the main activists on the... And it's Friday night, by the way, it's Shabbat, but more... There's a lot to say about that, but not now. So it's Shabbat, and we're there in this room. And I managed to, I know Amira Haas, who is a courageous Israeli journalist who has written about the reality of Palestinians for decades now, and in fact lives in Ramallah, is an Israeli citizen who lives in Ramallah, and a very remarkable and courageous person. And I invited her to come and meet with Vincent Harding. Vincent Harding was a historian, a colleague of Dr. Martin Luther King, and he also was the person who wrote the first draft of what I consider, maybe some of you consider, the most important speech that Martin Luther King gave. He gave many, by the way. This is not to in any way denigrate other speeches he gave, like I Have a Dream, which is a pretty magnificent and inspiring talk, and many others. But the talk that he gave in the Riverside Church where he came out against the war. So I'm sitting there in this room, in a very modest house, on the West Bank, after a day of tear gas, arrests, stones, armored vehicles, just a terrible day of, like, their regular day of what that nonviolent, unarmed resistance is about. And Amira comes to meet with Dr. Harding, and she comes to Dr. Harding, and she says, Dr. Harding, the most important question, the question I want to start with you is, you wrote that magnificent speech for Dr. King. He wrote the first draft, and actually, there's a lot in that speech that I had the privilege for the past 3 years, he just passed away, to get to know him, and I just reread the speech actually preparing for you for today, and I realized a lot of that speech is Vincent Harding. A lot of that speech is Vincent Harding. I'm sure a lot of it is Dr. King, too. But he said, Dr. Harding, you wrote that speech, and the speech starts with, a time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relationship to Vietnam. And I want to ask you, Dr. Harding, how you feel about the time has come when silence is betrayal. How come so many Americans, even those involved in civil rights struggles, have been silent about the question of Palestine, and how do you see your visit here? And he gave a very wonderful and profound answer about about how he had come to see that despite, rather with, his profound, Vincent had a profound, profound gratitude to Jews who had been profoundly and deeply important in his life, that he needed to travel to Palestine. And I feel very privileged that I was able to go with him, walk with him on that journey. King said that day, "Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony, but we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision, but we must speak. We must speak." Theodore Parker said, "I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice." As we heard, as you all know, I'm sure, Martin Luther King paraphrased these words. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. paraphrased these words in his famous "Where Do We Go From Here" speech, where he said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice." That lies at the heart of what prophetic faith is. The prophetic tradition is to believe that the arc of the universe bends towards justice. And the prophetic tradition believes that it's up to us to bend that arc. Let us give thanks for the prophetic inspiration of Theodore Parker, for all in history who have moved the arc of the moral universe towards justice. May we know that to speak of God and not to speak of justice for the Palestinians may also be blasphemy. May we be privileged to play our part in securing justice for them, for all people. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your words. I know there are, or I imagine there are questions among us. I want to invite people to come forward with their questions so that we can use the microphone so that everyone will be able to hear well. We have maybe 15 minutes or so, 15 or 20 minutes for conversation. So if there are those who have a question, you can raise your hand. I'll get as close as I can, but invite you to also come forward.
Or arguments. That's good.
Doesn't come too far. Yeah. I'm not sure where the hand held.
I'm going to stay here because this one.
My question really revolves a bit about the war this summer in Gaza. I brought up the issue of the treatment of Palestinians with a variety of Jewish friends, and the comment that constantly comes back to me is, they're, you know, digging tunnels into Israel and, you know, coming up in people's backyards. They're, you know, sending rockets into Israel continuously. Hamas has stated publicly that it wants Israel to be out of existence. How do you counter that kind of an argument?
Well, that's a great question, and a complicated question, but a really important one. I don't think you can really counter the question without really going to the heart of the matter, which is to say that the people in Gaza are surrounded and occupied, right? They have been attacked 3 times in the past 6 years, massively attacked. They are mostly refugees from Israel proper, right, from 1947. They've lived in conditions of being oppressed by Israel for all these years. They can't leave. They can't come. They can't they can't earn a living. They are a desperate people. They are under occupation, and they have a right to resist occupation. They don't have a right necessarily to kill civilians. I mean, I don't want to say that it's a moral thing to laud the morality of killing someone, but they do have a right to resist, and they are resisting oppression. That is what they're doing. In this case, in the case of Gaza, I mean, Israel also precipitated that war, right? Because Israel precipitated the war by its reaction to the kidnapping of those three Jewish children, teenagers, where it went and attacked various and arrested Hamas people all over the West Bank and so on. And that's what set in. Lastly, what I would say is the most important thing is Israel willing to end occupation? And we don't have any evidence that Israel's willing to end occupation. In fact, we have all the evidence that Israel's totally committed to in continuing that occupation. As long as the occupation exists, there's not going to be, there's always going to be resistance. There's always going to be violent resistance. Now, I'm not saying that you end the occupation and all violent resistance, all violence will end, but for sure violent resistance, we won't have violent resistance on the level that we have now. So that's why I would present the other side of that. So that's it.
I think this is on now.
Oh,
yeah, it's cordless.
Can you tell us who you are? Tell me. Yeah.
My name is Wendy Blum, and I'm a Jewish Unitarian.
Great.
And I just wanted to say that, I mean, I certainly relate to what you say, and I also have that very visceral fear. Mm-hmm. And I think that I just wondered what you would say to people who, to American Jews who feel very strongly about the plight of the Palestinians and wanting a just Israel, because that's what we always imagined and hoped for. How do you reassure people that the dissolution of Israel won't come to another Holocaust?
Well, I'm not suggesting the dissolution of Israel. I'm suggesting the creation of what I would say is my work in terms of justice is for equal rights for all people. In whatever way that they work that out in terms of politics, that will be, if it's one state or two states or three states or federation or whatever, what I'm committed to is equal rights, that all human beings are created in the image of God. I think in a situation where all human beings are created in the image of God and are treated, given equality, Jews will benefit from the greatest level of security, as will everyone. So I'm not arguing for the dissolution of Israel. I think you raise a very important point in the sense that many Jews feel that that's what's at stake here. I would say, Wendy, that, you know, I think the dissolution of Israel is mostly likely to happen, if it is, because of the actions of the government. I mean, Israel is facing worldwide condemnation. It's facing mass violence and resistance. It's facing children, their children, who are being killed. I mean, I did give a sermon about Gaza this high holidays, and one of the things for me was that my child, 16-year-old, was in Israel during that war, and she was on a Zionist program, not the most extreme Zionist program, but the best one that in our family we could work out that she would go to. And she knew her Israeli, and she was on a program which was wonderful. It was 12 Israeli kids and 12 American Jewish kids. And her Israeli friends, who she became very close to, actually she had a friend whose brother was killed in the ground invasion into Gaza. So there's that terrible loss of life that's happening, and I think creating a situation where there's equal rights will prevent that, will break that cycle. That's what I would say. But I would want to, I sort of want to address it emotionally. I also want to reassure people and the Jew in mind that you have in mind, and that's in you or in me, is to say, you know, that We're not here talking about the dissolution. This is not the Holocaust. This is an attempt to create a thriving Jewish community in Israel. So, yeah.
My name is Thea Ibral. I'm Jewish. I recently moved here from California. And you talk about prophetic religions. I always wonder why the Haredim can justify a violence. It's not something that I was ever brought up to believe in, and yet there's these images of violence by the Haredim. Thank you.
Do you mean more this justification of violence by religious Jews? Is that what you mean? Yeah, because Haredim are one particular branch of religious Jews, and they're not necessarily the ones who would most legitimate it, although they would too, some of them. To tell you the truth, I believe that all three traditions, and probably all religious traditions, but Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, have violent teachings deep in their faith. Right? I definitely know that's true of Christianity and Judaism. I think it's true probably also of Islam. And alongside that, we have prophetic teachings about justice and love. And so the question is, why do people do it? It's because it's in the teaching itself. The fear that Wendy raised is a fear that is manifest in Jewish scripture, right? It's a fear that's manifest in the struggle between Jacob and Esau and Isaac and Ishmael. There's only blessing for one of the kids, and they're all trying to fight with this one blessing. In our time, I believe that the question, I have this image of Esau that comes from the Bible. Esau comes to his father after Jacob has stolen the blessing, and he is bereft. He can't believe what's just happened, that Jacob's stolen the blessing from him. And he turns to his real father, but actually it's a question not only to that father, but to the projected father, the Godfather, you know, the Father God, saying, you know, do you have only one blessing, my father? So I think there's a scarcity that's built into those three traditions that then is translated into violence. Maybe that's human. Maybe that's human. But anyway, what we need to do is to reassure people that it's not a zero-sum game. It's not either me or you. It's us together, you know. It's both of us together. So, and that's the prophetic tradition. It's all human beings. It's not a particular human being. I could tell you more about this, but I mean, in the sermon that I gave, that I'm willing, if you want it, I raised this question too, because I think that for me, the Jewish ideas of chosenness and promised land are the teachings that we need to struggle with. And ultimately, I think reject. I mean, not ultimately, I think we need to reject them. I don't want a Judaism that has either a promised land. I don't mind a promised land that's a promised land for everyone with equality. But I don't want a promised land which is a promised land for me and not for you. And I don't want a chosen people that's a chosen people for me and not for you. Because I don't think that's the highest part of our tradition. Yeah. Sure.
My name is Paul Jameson. I'm an ex-Catholic and now a humanist. My question has to do with dealing within the political system. During the last election, candidates on both sides supported Israel no matter what.
Sure.
And it was difficult to figure out how I could be most effective politically, and I wondered what your thoughts are about modifying the political system so that we don't support Israel militarily.
Oh. I think we need to build up a strong grassroots movement that will challenge the politicians. And that's the only way to do it. I don't think the political system is going to be reformed about this issue or any other issue. We don't have much of a democracy anymore. Our democracy has been bought by lobbies and special interests and serves the needs of the rich and the powerful. So we need to have an alternative source of power, and the alternative source of power is human beings organizing like we are right here. We are an alternative source of power. And so there are lots of things that you know, there's a U.S. campaign against the occupation, so there are, but I assume you know those kinds of things, right? There's a U.S. campaign against the occupation. There's solidarity, Palestinian solidarity groups. There are groups that challenge U.S. aid to Israel. So you can definitely support those. I don't think it's going to make a dent yet in the fact that all American politicians are going to sign on the dotted line as regards to Israel, because that's a question of money. It's a question of they're not making a principal choice to support Israel, nor do they make a principal choice about most things. They make a choice based on what's going to get them reelected. And the institutional power that has been invested in promoting the adherence of American politicians to supporting the state of Israel is being very well done. It's very successful. It's very powerful, and it's very successful. There is an alternative. There are alternatives being created, but nothing that's really challenging those. Oh, can possibly. I would say the last sentence I can remember, I don't think I'm at this age, I don't think I remember. I did say that I didn't think the system would get altered. I thought that we should work grassroots, we should put grassroots. And I said I thought that the politicians who supported Israel, I mean the kinds of letters that go through Congress are just passed by people because they're intimidated. If they don't pass it, they may get targeted by the Israel lobby, and if they get targeted by the Israel lobby, they may lose their jobs. So they don't want to lose their jobs. That's not what politicians want to do. It's not what anyone wants to do, so they go along with it. Now, there are politicians who are beginning to not sign along, right? There's pressure, and that's where we come in. We can put pressure on politicians to not sign along, to not just, you know, like Bernie Sanders or other people that sometimes don't forcefully say, I'm not going to sign on, or Elizabeth Warren, right? You know? What?
I have to say that I received an extremely disappointing letter.
Sure.
Elizabeth Warren, I wrote about Gaza and the killing of the children.
Right.
She wrote back, I believe in Israel's right to defend itself.
Correct.
And the story.
Right.
So it's extremely depressing.
Right.
For those
who work for her. Right. Right. Is that what you wanted me to repeat? Did that do it? No, I'm serious. I'm not being facetious or anything.
I was involved in the Christian Marxist dialogue in the 60s and 70s. Christian Marxist dialogue, and was involved in East Germany in particular. And I taught the Holocaust at two universities in Nebraska in the cornfields. And so I, you know, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I feel one way, and Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, I feel another way, and I'm just totally confused sometimes. But one of the things that I've always come back to, as a disciple of Kings, I wish we could send missionaries into the Palestinian country, to teach people active nonviolent resistance on the model of King, because it would work against Israel, I'm convinced.
Well, there are Palestinians who are engaged in principled nonviolence like that. There's no shortage of Palestinian nonviolence. There also is Palestinian violent armed resistance, but there is mostly Palestinian, and most of resistance of Palestinians over time has not been violent. It's been nonviolent. I mean, Palestinians have done tax revolts, have done various kinds of nonviolent resistance, and there is a tradition of active nonviolent resistance to Israel, to the injustices in their society. It is alongside also violent or armed resistance. So it's not so easy to imagine. I mean, it may work. Palestinian nonviolent resistance may work. There's no, I don't know of many major changes in human history in terms of justice that haven't involved some kind of violent resistance. I understand. No, I'm just telling you the facts. I'm not telling you that that's the desideratum. That's what is. I mean, did South Africa change, my country change nonviolently? No. Was there a lot of nonviolence? Absolutely. There was incredible principled nonviolence. I would think that's the same as Palestinians. I mean, Palestinians clearly have taken some kind of actions, violent actions, that have been particularly troubling and particularly disturbing, right? But, you know, even Stevens, it's not like the Israeli side hasn't done similar acts, but you know.
Hi, my name is Jessica Mink, and I'm a member of the church here. And my daughter works for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation.
Good for her.
So I'm pretty aware. I got a letter, similar letter, from Elizabeth Warren when I've written to her several times, instigated by my daughter's group. But I think one of the things about that we are not aware of is the extent of the you've mentioned it, but Americans don't know that the Palestinians have resisted nonviolently a lot.
Right.
And my daughter spent a year after she graduated from college teaching peace in Beirut at a private high school that had students from all over the Middle East. And the thing she figured out was that the United States was way more in need of education about peace than the people in the Middle East were. And I think one of the things we need to think about is what we have to do to fellow Americans to change things, because
right.
That's where we can work.
Right.
And so do you have any suggestions for, this is like a global thing. It's not really just Israel and Palestine. It's this, it goes across the board in the Middle East especially, but there's a definite attitude in this country.
Right.
That the way you settle things is violence.
Right. So the question, I mean, I don't have a quick answer, and I'm not, you know, I share your concern, and I share your concern, too, about the violence. And I think that we need to work out a way of social change and of living that's non-military. So it's anti-militarist work. Now, the United States is one of the most important, I mean, in the King's speech that we referred to earlier, one of the really very powerful things in that speech is that he said, you know, my country is the main provider of military technology and the main purveyor of violence in the world. It hasn't changed much since then. So we need to figure out how we have a non, and our budget is 50% for the military, right? We spend $1 out of every $2 at least for military, for so-called defense spending. Can we build a world that's not based on militarism? I mean, that's the issue that was asked earlier about the question you asked about the, you know, people arguing about, well, they want to take over, they want to destroy the tunnels and so on and so forth. The question is, there is no military solution here. Israel's operating on the fact that there's a military solution. There may be Palestinians too operating on the fact that there's a military solution. There is no military solution. There's only a political solution. I mean, what happened in Gaza was an attempt by both sides in some ways, although I don't want to say, you know, Palestinians were here attacked and were much less powerful, but essentially they were, you know, in South Africa. When did South Africa change? South Africa changed when people realized there's no military solution. F.W. de Klerk realized we're never going to beat the black resistance movement. The black resistance movement realized they're never going to defeat the military power of apartheid. And they sat down and worked out a change that would be peaceful. That's what needs to happen. I think I want to end.
Thank you, yes.
I'd be happy to stay, but I thank you. Thank you, everyone.
I want to thank Rabbi Walt for joining us this afternoon and invite everyone to join us in the parish hall, which is the building just behind us over here, for some refreshments and some music and more conversation, I guess, if Rabbi Walt is up for that. We'll see how it goes. Thank you very much for being with us today. A small gift for you. Yes. Thank you for being here. We have our work cut out for us, all of us, I think. I thank the committee that put all this together this afternoon, and keep your eyes posted on our website for the next lecture. Take good care.